Welcome everybody. I'm Jason Tundra. I'm your host for a special episode of the BAMP podcast. My guest needs no introduction, but I'm going to do it anyway. Jonathan Tweet is one of the most creative and influential people in our gaming business, in our hobby and our business. Most of you will know him from lead designer on 3rd edition of Dungeons & Dragons. But you're also the creator and co-creator of many other incredibly popular and fan favorite RPGs, including my favorite game of all time, which is Ars Magica.
Okay.
I have a new Ars Magica group starting up.
Really?
Yes, around an actual physical table.
Okay.
Down in Renton.
That's old school.
Actually, no, I think back. Actually, we meet up on the west side.
Okay.
Yes, it is old school. You also helped to create the original Over the Edge.
That's right.
Which is 20 or 25
years? 25 years old.
25 years old now. And then there was 3rd edition.
That's right.
And then
99.
And then 13th Age.
13th Age, right, 2013.
And then now you've gone into a whole new field now.
That's
now
right.
You do a children's book, you
That's
do
right.
Grandmother Fish, and
That's
I want
right.
you to tell us about that. And you do Clay, which
That's
is
right.
a, both a card game and an app.
That's right.
So there's a lot of this is gonna feel like an Inside the Actor studio, because I want to walk through like every part of that career.
Don't
we won't have time. What's that?
Don't forget it.
Oh, and I can't believe I got it away. So right, this is right, was it right after 3rd edition?
This is 95.
Okay.
It's the first right. thing I did for Wizards of the Coast after I hired on there.
And I cannot forget it, because I have that exact box on my shelf at home. And as I was telling before we got started, that's because the first time I met Jonathan, although I was one of only many, many millions of screaming fans, was when I came walking by the Wizards of the Coast booth looking for work, trying to write for whatever game I could. And I loved Everway, because it was finding a way to incorporate the card fan into the role-playing game
right.
fans, sort of trying to bring those two things together.
Yep.
But also it was really multicultural
yeah.
for its time,
right.
and it still is in many ways.
Right, 95, right? It holds up really well.
It does hold up really well. So we're going to jump into the Wayback Machine on probably some of these things, and there's so much to say. But let's start with Over the Edge,
that's
because
right.
that's why we're here.
That's right. That hit shelves in June, so that's...
Yeah, and this is my copy, I think,
yep,
and you brought your own.
Yep.
There's so much to say about this game, but I want to start, because I was a big fan from the very first edition.
Thank
and
you.
And I remember reading it. There was this coffee shop outside the university when I was an undergrad.
Yeah.
And I would just find the couch, you know, and I would go over this. And all the plots just blew my mind. And I actually got to play it only a couple of times,
okay.
but I played it at a Gen Con with Nephew, I think.
Okay, yeah.
As the GM, and I played the reincarnation of Leonardo da Vinci.
And that's a new one.
I was the only death. We were in the terminal.
Yeah.
And I got to watch John do the terminal gag for new players, which
right.
I had always thought about, but never, was where you draw the terminal,
yeah.
and then you draw the ground,
yeah.
and blow their mind,
right?
Right.
right.
there was aliens invading the terminal. And he
yeah,
was using
yeah.
the deck of On the Edge, the card game
sure,
at the time, as
that's
a
right.
plot generator.
Right, because John Nephew and I did that together.
Right, and so he would turn over characters
yep.
and things. And we finally found, like, the portal to the other alien dimension. And of course, I put my head in to look. And that was the end of the session and the end of my character. And I had to do it.
You had to, are you?
It had to be done.
That's how we learned.
I don't think I learned not to put my head in the alien portals. I think I learned to play more Over the Edge.
Yeah, all right.
But anyway, now I'm talking about my game, which I never do.
Yeah, you told me about your character, didn't you?
I did. I can't, yeah. Well, I'm nerding out.
All right. I have to say, so on that
yes.
topic,
yes.
for each of my games, it seems like there's the cool thing that people want to tell me about. For Ars Magica, it's our covenant is so cool.
Yes.
We're on wagons and we're going through Spain, right?
Yeah.
And for Everway, it's this realm was so cool because the men were all dogs and the women were all cats or whatever.
Right.
And for Over the Edge, it's characters.
Yeah,
I was
characters.
The reincarnation of Leonardo da Vinci. That's
yeah.
what it's interesting to hear what people say.
Yeah. Well, so Over the Edge had a second edition.
That's right.
In the meantime there.
Yep.
In this game, and your emphasis with this version, is this the second edition right here, this hardback?
This is the second edition.
Yeah.
One.
The was to do a a game that was not just a refresh.
That's right.
It was not just updating the timeline 10 years or 15 years from the second edition.
Exactly.
But to rewrite it completely. Yeah,
that's right.
And the terminal's a good example of that because it's not upside down anymore.
That's right. Yeah. So the terminal was from Robin D. Laws, and there's no way I could improve on what he did.
Oh, really?
Right? It was like, so I didn't even try.
Didn't even try. Yeah. I remember when I got the book and I started looking through it, the first thing I looked for was Throckmorton because I wanted to see what you had done with it.
Yeah.
And of course, in the world we live in today,
right,
Throckmorton plot, it's kind of an anticlimactic, because we have real fascism.
That's right. Right. So the Throckmorton plot was about fascist rising and intolerance and whatever, which was like, oh, kind of interesting to think about.
All right.
25 years ago. And now it's like, Yeah.
You've recast the whole story, really, as this idea of a kind of dimensional war where our universe is being colonized by another universe.
That's right.
And what happens is that we can see effects from that colonization happening. So can you believe it? Like in this other universe, Trump won the election.
Yeah.
And when I was reading those first few pages, I was like, oh man, this is effing brilliant. And like I know it seems impossible, but remember how close that election was.
Right.
And now
Hillary won handily in the popular election, but the electoral college was really close, and we could have lost that one.
Yeah. and so. So tell me what led to that.
Sure.
That vision of
how to redo it.
How to redo it.
Right. Okay. So the number one thing about Over the Edge back in 1992 was that it was not derivative.
Yeah.
Right. It had plenty of inspiration, but it was all new.
Yeah.
Right. Well, you can't do a new edition that's derivative of the earlier one and have it still be the same game, because then it will become derivative.
Right.
So Chris Lights, he helped me on this edition, and in fact, he inspired me to take this seriously. He contacted me years ago and, hey, if you ever do a new edition, I want to help. And for me, it's like, how do you do a new edition of a game whose whole identity is that it's not derivative? And so I said, no, it's just, I don't think I'm ever going to do another edition. How could I do that?
Yeah.
And then, you know, over the years, I guess, he talked to me some more, and I thought about it some more.
You wore your dad.
And I finally realized, once it became my idea, then I thought it was a good one.
So he had to inception you a little bit.
Exactly. And so then I realized, if I changed everything,
yes,
then it would have the same freshness.
Yeah.
And the same sort of lack of baggage.
Yep.
That the original had.
I totally understand.
And so, the other thing is, I was kind of worried whether, do I still have the chops, right?
Like, yeah.
Over the Edge is a really hard game to follow, right? Yeah. And
it's a challenging game, and I want to touch on this, but go on.
And then I got into it, and I was like, oh, yeah, I think I can do this, right? And then it turned out better. And then the really big difference is the game system.
Yes, okay, so let's talk about that, since that was on my list anyway, and you brought it up. So the original game system, which came to be called the Warp system,
that's right,
but originally it didn't have a name.
That's right.
It's really simple and straightforward, and when I was doing my Arthur Lives urban fantasy game, one version of that game used that system. But this is a new system.
That's right.
And you talk about that a little bit in the game. Yeah. You say, like, well, you know, you've already got the warp system. You already know how that works. So let's give you something new.
Yeah.
But was there more to it than that?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. So part of it was, when I started creating Over the Edge, it was specifically meant to be a game that was unpublishable.
Really?
Really. It was like, so...
Well, I read that it was your home campaign.
It was my home campaign. And it was my home campaign when I was out of the game industry. I was done with games, right? Like, I had a rocky breakup with the original Lion Rampant and my former best friend, Mark Reinhagen, and whatever, right?
Yeah.
And so I was selling mutual funds, and that was my new career.
Really? Wow.
Yeah.
It's hard to imagine.
It is. It's hard for me to imagine, and I did it.
Yeah.
And so I was tired of Ars Magica, where I would say, here are all the rules you have to learn in order to create a character.
Yeah.
And you know what? You can't really be a gypsy because they weren't around yet.
Yeah.
And there's all like a bring down on people's creativity. And so,
having run the game many times, I know exactly what you're talking about.
Right. I mean, once you get into it, it gives you all this richness yes. and whatever, but there's the onboarding.
There's steep onboarding.
Right? So I wanted something where I could say, make up a character.
Yeah.
And that was, you didn't need to know the game system or the setting.
Yep.
Right? And then I wanted it to be sort of weirder and more profane and simpler
yep.
than anybody would want to publish.
Yeah.
And it was like my, in you know, Declaration of Independence from game publishing. I can do my right. thing for my people, yeah. my way, and I don't care whether anybody likes it.
Was right? this the first thing you had done that was all you?
Yes, that's right. That's right. I mean, I've been doing amateur game design right. since I was 12, yeah, yeah. right? Like, absolutely. Because I went to the game store and the second game that I wanted, Metamorphosis Alpha, it cost $5.
right?
But I didn't have $5. So I went home and I made up a game about mutants and lasers and whatever. And, yes. and back then, the games were not that good.
No.
So you could, as an amateur, come up with a pretty reasonable game that.
Yeah. Yeah, we learned a lot.
Learned a lot. So I had already done tons and tons of my own game design.
Yeah.
And but this was sort of everything that I had learned about character creation and plot and drama and whatever, really, where I had developed a lot of those skills working on Ars Magica, and now I was sort of cutting loose.
Yeah.
Right. And so John Nephew heard about my campaign and wanted to publish it, and I tried to talk him out of it, and he wouldn't hear it. and so the game was simple, but I wound up sort of bolting on an attack system
yes.
where, you know, you would compare numbers and you would roll to see who went first and you would do rounds because I played a more freeform way, but there was no way that I could get across to game masters how to play that way, right? And so I created a structure that made it reasonable, but that's the part of the system that really looks old-fashioned. When you look back at the game, it's very fresh and interesting, and then it has this, you know, roll to hit, you know, subtract numbers, subtract hit points.
Multiply by your weapon type.
Multiply by your weapon type. Apply armor, right?
Yeah.
And so, well, you know, games have gotten past that. Everwage, just a couple of years later, got past
that's
that.
Right.
You didn't have armor class, you didn't have rolls to hit, yeah. right? None of that. And then one of the things that really inspired me, I've been a big fan of Vincent Baker's work ever since he wrote Kill Puppies for Satan.
Okay.
And sort of sent it to me in an unmarked package.
Fantastic. yeah. Now, I confess, I'm not super familiar with his work, so you'll have
to. Okay, so Dogs in the Vineyard was a really...
I know Dogs in the Vineyard.
So that was really big. And then his latest Apocalypse World is now
sort of
the engine for all sorts of stuff.
Yes.
And in Apocalypse World...
I read several different Apocalypse Power games.
Yeah, that's right. So, and what I like is, while Baker was inspired by me, now I get to be inspired by him. And so I've gone back to the people who were inspired by Over the Edge and Everway, and I've stolen their ideas.
Yeah,
right? And one of the things that impressed me with Apocalypse World was how much weight there is on a die roll. Because the game master doesn't roll dice, so your roll is both your attempt to defeat your opponent or whatever, and if you roll badly, their ability to hurt you.
Yes.
So there's twice as much
stakes
on every die. Well, the more stakes are on a die roll, the more interesting it is, right? In Dungeons and Dragons, there are a lot of die rolls that are like pretty uninteresting.
Yeah,
right?
Roll perception.
Yeah, or like roll damage. You roll a bunch of dice, and it's like, well, I got about average. Like, we all have to wait for you to like add up all your dice, and right?
Yeah, I see.
There's not that much going on that, right? So I thought, how much can you put on a die roll? And so now the whole new system is based on rolling 2 6-sided dice.
Yes.
And then based on your odds, like how you stack up against the opposition, you might be able to re-roll the dice you don't like, or the game master might make you re-roll the dice that they don't like, and then you end up with a result, and that generally determines how things turn out.
Right.
So you can fail on a single die roll. Right?
And there's a double threes and double fours as well, right?
Yeah, so what happens is you're trying to roll as high as possible.
Yes.
Usually you're trying to roll a 7 or an 8, right? So that's pretty easy. But threes are bad twists and fours are good twists.
Right.
So you can succeed with a 6 and a 3, But the three is a bad twist, right? So, you know, yes, you did manage to get out of the flaming building, but the bad twist is you lost the thing that you were trying to rescue.
So there's a certain amount of narrative levers that the both the GM and the player can manipulate a little bit.
That's right.
And this brings us to the whole question of the loss.
Yeah.
In one of the things that I always found interesting about Over the Edge, and this carried through to the recent game, is that you're willing to do rules which kind of push players out of their comfort zones a little bit.
Yes.
Right?
Like I make people draw their characters.
Now, see, that was my exact example. From the first book, the first edition, where you must draw your character. There are no excuses. you must draw. And you know, and you give like a, you throw a bone, like, okay, well, if you can draw like a symbol or a thing, if you, because people get intimidated by trying to draw a human figure.
That's right.
You know, okay, like a picture of something. But really, the spirit of the rule is that you have to draw your character. Right. And even if you're not a very good artist, and the argument that you give in the book is that it sort of it creates a link between your physical memory and your thought memory.
Yes.
But then in this new game, and it is really a whole new game, you add this idea of the lots.
Yeah.
So tell us about lots.
Yeah. Well, you know, a fellow named Christopher Dyslexy, maybe I'm getting his name wrong, I meant to look it up, but he mentioned to me years ago that role-playing games are kind of like a ritual.
Yeah.
And I thought about it, it is kind of true,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And that sort of fit with things that I'd been thinking about. What does it mean to sit down with somebody else and address them as the person that they are not, right? Yes. Hey, Thorvald, or whatever.
Right.
When you roll dice in a role-playing game, it's kind of like rolling oracle bones, only it's true what happens, right?
Right.
And it obviously, in every way, you're drawing a card. It's like a fortune deck, and you really are determining your future,
right?
And what people used to do to determine, like, who is the person on the ship that's causing the storm is you would cast lots. Right. You would roll dice.
And hope that you weren't that
unlucky. And hope you didn't get the number one. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And so I just doubled down on that and came up with sort of this whole rigmarole about how you should select, you know, one pair of dice to be your pair of dice, and you don't use those for any other game as long as you've got the Over the Edge campaign going,
and you can't roll any other dice.
And
you
have to roll any of those specific dice,
and no matter how well or how poorly they behave, you can't throw them in the toilet.
Right.
You can't melt them.
It's your destiny.
It's your destiny,
right?
And you don't use it for any other game.
Right.
And what I find interesting about that, and one of the women in my current gamer group, she did a whole master's thesis on dice rituals in gaming.
Wow.
Yeah. So, and Hannah.
Hey, Hannah.
Yeah. So she would be fascinated by this, because these are really sacrosanct traditions to people.
Yes.
Like being able to pick your dice and you're like, no, you have to use these.
Yeah.
And have you got any pushback about this?
Oh, sure. Like a lot of people really like it because it, you know, it plays into the personality, right? And it's fun.
It is fun.
Right? And it means, like, these are the dice that have screwed you. These very dice, and you have to roll them again. Right? Like, there's emotion there. There were some playtesters who were like, well, this is all stupid. We didn't do it. And you don't have to do it. You can, right?
Yeah.
You can use an electronic generator to generate your numbers. It's fine.
Right. But where's the heart in that?
Yeah. And so I play it like, you can't change your dice. You have to stick with them. But whatever. I also say rules are for breaking.
Yeah.
Right? There's no... Yeah. Every time I see in here, you must do this, it really means you must do this unless you think for yourself.
Yeah, right. This is how I do it.
And maybe I'm going over the top to point out that people are always trying to tell you what to do.
Oh,
and
right.
It really is up to you to have to decide what to
do. That's always been a major theme of Over the Edge,
right?
The whole control and this idea that to some degree human beings are kind of programmed to obey.
Yeah.
And realizing that we don't have to do, breaking out of that is a really challenging thing. Well, so there's so much cool stuff in this game. It came out how recently?
So June 1st was the street date.
Okay, because I must have gotten mine right around there.
We did a big Kickstarter for it last year, and so
The layout's really great too. The graphic design and the whole layout. It's really this is where I went. You know, it was my Moxie, my local store. But the importance of graphic design, you know, on gaming these days has really changed. And I mean, it's good. We all love it. The books become a lot harder to make. They become a lot more expensive to produce.
That's true.
But they become very enjoyable as kind of objects of art in and of themselves, and we love reading them.
Yeah, I'm glad you like it. Yeah, put a lot of work into it.
Who did the graphic design? I'm asking you.
Yeah, Thomas Dean.
You did a great job on it.
Yeah, thank you.
Okay. So what kind of... And you already told me the story that Chris kind of was the person that kind of got this into you.
Before we leave the graphic design, I want to say that that's... Over the Edge had always been kind of an indie game with sort of passable art and passable layout and whatever. And now, being able to raise money on Kickstarter...
Oh, yes.
Right? And also just the growth of role-playing games means that, like, it's the best map ever for...
It really is.
Over the Edge. It's the best art. It's the best layout. There's stuff in here that's so good. It's the best cover. Right? Very happy about it.
How did the Kickstarter perform?
It did about as well as we expected, which was good. 130,000.
Wow.
Think. Yeah.
Oh, that's phenomenal. Congratulations. Yeah. And that was last year.
That was last year. Okay.
So, support? I mean, I've got shelves of a whole shelf full of Over the Edge stuff.
One thing is, like, you can still get from Atlas.
That's right.
All the old Over the Edge stuff, and the rules are different, but the rules make up of just a fraction.
And honestly, to my eye, the conversion is very easy.
Yeah.
Like moving from Warp to the new system
is
super easy. Yeah.
So that support is all there. And then Justin Alexander is the guy doing role playing games at Atlas. And he's getting, it's going to be a set of adventures, including one of mine.
Oh, that's great. It's
coming out later this year.
Oh, fantastic. Yeah, that's great. Right. Do we have a name for any of that stuff yet?
We do.
But you can't. That's all right. That's good. Something for us to look forward to.
Yeah.
So, there was just something that you were. There's a change in the character creation.
Yes.
In the sense that a lot of the psychic powers and a lot of the stuff that was supernatural and superhuman has kind of been discouraged in the new edition. Go ahead, please.
So the one big thing is another thing I learned from Apocalypse World.
Yes.
Is that your enemies in Apocalypse World are always human. Like, even the most inhuman, like the ghouls or whatever, they're still human, and that's important.
Yes.
Because that makes their inhumanity matter. And so you can still be any kind of epigenetic, psychic, Leonardo da Vinci, reincarnated, whatever. But one of the rules is you have to be human.
You can't play the Archangel Michael.
That's right. Anymore. You may not. It's against the rules.
Which, of course, as you said, is just really a way for us to break the rules. Yeah.
But it sets the ground thing, like, okay, if you want to play Archangel Michael, how are you still going to be human? How are you still going to matter to the other humans who are literally with you at the table?
And it's a question of creating characters that are relatable and that people can empathize
with. That's right.
Because this is a game about our shared humanity.
Thank you. That's right.
That we have more in common with each other than we have differences.
Yeah.
Right on.
And we're weird. And we're very weird.
And we embrace our weirdness, though.
That's right. No, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Right? So you don't have to be non-human to be weird. That's right.
Yeah. All right. Well, there's a million other things I want to talk about, but Over the Edge.
Yeah, boom.
It's a fantastic game. Best version of the game ever. Best version of itself.
Yep.
And all new, it did. It got completely rewritten
right now. That's
from scratch.
You still have baboons and centipedes and, right, but yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So tell me about some of the stuff that you're doing these days, because I see Gremlin of Fish and I see Clades, and this is a children's book you put out.
It's a children's book.
And there's a great story about how you came up with
this. Super story.
So tell me about it.
Yeah. So all the time that I was working at Wizards and working on these games and whatever, in the background at home, I was working on a book of evolution for little kids. Right? So I had a little daughter, yes. and like parents everywhere throughout history, we wanted to explain where we came from.
Yeah.
And there are plenty of Adam and Eve books for little kids, but there's no Darwin book for little kids. And so I figured I needed to write it.
Yeah.
And so it was called Old Mother Fish.
Okay.
And I started, I worked on it, and it was a great idea,
yeah.
but I'm not a children's book author.
Right.
And it got to a point where I thought it was pretty good, but it wasn't. And I kind of stalled out. It's like, what? How do I make this better? You know? And that version would coax children to compare themselves to our ancestors.
Okay.
Right?
Yes.
So Old Mother Fish had a tail. Do you have a tail?
Right.
Okay. Kind of interactive. And then within a month after getting squeezed out of my last corporate job, I was smoking weed in my hot tub. Thinking about the origins of language in shamanic rituals where like maybe shamans would imitate lions to teach people how to hunt lions or whatever. And I realized that's what the book needed, right? So there's this great spiritual tradition all around the world of like embodying your ancestors or whatever,
yeah,
and
yeah.
that's what the book does. So now
Merlin turns Arthur into animals so he can teach him how to be king.
Yeah, there you
yeah,
go.
Exactly.
So now Grandmother Fish could wiggle and swim fast. Can you wiggle? And so it turned into actions.
Yeah.
Right?
Okay.
So now the kids do a thing, right? They breathe like Grandmother Reptile, or they hoot like Grandmother Ape.
Yeah.
And so it tells a story from Grandmother Fish to Grandmother Reptile, Grandmother Mammal, who can cuddle with her children and feed them milk.
They can squeak.
And they can squeak? Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And then Grandmother Ape, and finally Grandmother Human, who can walk and talk and
yeah.
tell stories. And so then you're reading to your own child about Grandmother Human telling stories.
Yeah.
And it's this recursive, you know, this is where we came from
yeah.
story.
Yeah.
And
you found an amazing artist.
Found an amazing artist. So she's local, she's a Seattle area artist, a mom, and she does children's science illustration.
Oh, yeah.
So she can go to each one of these ancient animals and, wow, that really does look like an ishnacanthus. And paleontologists say, oh, that's an ishnacanthus, right? But it's a happy, friendly ishnacanthus.
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
A lot of natural science animal art, they kind of look taxidermied.
Yeah.
Right?
Okay,
like they,
sure.
they look real. They look like a real stuffed animal.
Yeah.
And she really makes them cheeky. And
sure, her name again is Karen.
Karen Lewis.
Karen Lewis.
Yeah.
yeah. And she's local.
She's local. And she did a great book on like crows and something on salmon.
So you were able to meet with her physically in
exactly.
person. Exactly. That was a huge, and that must have been.
That was tremendous.
Yeah.
That was tremendous. So she helped me with some of the wording. I got advice from sort of friends on layout
yeah.
and whatever, and you know, we went back and forth on the art. And so, like I said, well, we need an image of Grandmother Ape. She looks like this ape proconsul that lived 30 million years ago or whatever.
Okay.
And she came back with an illustration of that ape with a baby ape. Okay, well, that's more work.
Right.
But way better.
Well, way better.
So then I said, well, if we're going to do that, then go back to Grandmother Reptile and give her a clutch of eggs.
So the
right?
keep
and
that.
And give that theme, right?
Yeah.
And so, and boy, kids love that. Kids love animals, they love families,
yeah.
and then this book says, you're part of the animal family.
Yeah. Yeah. So you published it, the first edition,
right.
you published yourself.
That's right.
But now there's a new edition.
Yeah, Macmillan. So in 2015, we printed 3,000 copies, and we gave half of them out to the Kickstarter backers,
yeah.
and there was a really nice blog post on an NPR blog that went viral,
oh.
and boom, we sold out. And then an agent got in contact with us, got the PDF, and shipped it around to publishers.
Oh,
we had three different publishers bidding on it.
Wow, what a great position.
Was that a nice position?
Yeah.
And then we went to Macmillan, and there were multiple imprints within Macmillan that each
yes.
wanted it. So I'm like talking to the publishers about what they'll do with the book, and
yeah.
right? And
wow.
Yeah, so that went really well. And then the publisher, so it's Fireball and Friends, and they didn't ask for any changes in the text or the illustrations. They say it's really uncommon for a first-time
yeah.
children's book author to be able to come up with, you know, text that doesn't need to be
fixed, but this was a long process.
This was a long process, and I really got a lot of help from friends, right? Yeah. So for my years in the game industry,
yes.
I've got artist friends and writer friends and editor
yeah,
friends.
Totally.
And so like one husband-wife team of friends of mine, old friends, you know, the wife said, it's got to be fewer words because it's a kid's book. And
yes.
then the dad said, their parents, right? It's got to have more details. It's like, okay, I can make that work, right?
Fewer words, but more details,
right?
Yeah.
And so, well, they were both right.
They were both right.
And so, but without that help, I think they probably would have asked for changes.
Yeah, I've only been working at Paizo. I'm an editor there.
Yeah.
I've only been working there for about a year and a half.
Yeah.
But I've really come to appreciate how much of a collaborative process all of this creativity
yeah.
is.
Definitely.
I mean, there's editors and art directors and designers and developers, and we make these amazing products. We don't do it by ourselves.
That's right.
We do it with a huge team.
That's right.
So now we've got a second edition.
That's right. So that came out in 2016. It's been translated into Italian and Chinese
I'm
and
kidding.
It's Japanese.
That's
yeah.
awesome.
Well, so the thing is, like what the publisher said is, this is not a book about a kite. Right? Meaning, you know, there are lots of children's books that
yes.
are cute children's books or whatever, but this is everybody's story. This is the story of humanity. This is the story of the animal kingdom that we know. And so, yeah, the Chinese and Japanese can read this very same story, and it relates to them just like it relates to you and me and everybody.
Yes, because we can all hoot.
Because we can all hoot. That's right.
So, is there any connection between this and Clade?
Yes.
Okay. They seem related.
They totally seem related. So Clades is, actually it's two card games, Clades
yeah.
and Clades Prehistoric.
Clades and Clades Prehistoric.
And so when I was doing research for Grandmother
yes.
Fish, I had to learn a lot about evolution. I had to learn about our evolutionary past. And right?
yeah.
And one of the things I learned is what a Clade is.
So tell us what a Clade is.
So a clade is a complete branch of an evolutionary family
oh,
tree.
Yeah, okay, right. And there's this tree, and you write about how difficult it was to do this evolutionary
yeah.
tree. So let's look at it.
Yeah.
This was the page that you didn't want to do because it was going to be so much work, but now that it's here,
yeah.
no one can take their eyes off
That's
it.
Right. I said we shouldn't do it. It'll be a lot of work. And the artist said we have to do it. Kids will love it. And
she,
we were both right.
We were both. yeah, yeah. Okay, so a clade is like a whole
right.
branch of
Yeah,
this.
So put your finger anywhere
yeah,
on
like here.
Here. And then everything downstream from that is a clade. So
I
if you
see.
Right, put your finger here, this is all is a clade.
Okay.
You put your finger here, that's a clade.
I got
Put you. Your finger here, that's a clade.
I see.
Right?
Yeah.
So for example, the category reptile is not a clade. Because there's no place that you can put your finger that includes all reptiles but not birds. Birds are not reptiles.
Oh, I see.
So reptile is an old-fashioned category that
yeah.
really paleontologists don't use anymore because it doesn't represent a natural group of animals. So these are all sauropsids. And sauropsids is all the animals that were descended from these very early reptile-like animals.
Yeah.
Right? So that's dinosaurs and birds and plesiosaurs and everything.
Yeah. Right? yeah.
So that's a clade. Well, that is a super powerful concept. Once you understand clades, like humans are a clade, humans plus chimps and bonobos together are a clade.
Right.
Humans plus chimps plus bonobos plus gorillas are a clade. Gorillas are their own clade. Bonobos are their own clade. Chimps are their own clade. Chimps and bonobos are a clade. Right? Once you understand how these things nest, they're
yeah.
all based on shared ancestors.
Yeah.
Well, common descent is obvious, right? There's no,
right.
there's no way you can look at that and go, but evolution isn't true. Like, you could just see how everything lines up.
Yeah. All right.
And
so
big concept.
Yes.
Very excited about it. I thought I knew a lot about biology and evolution, and I didn't know what a clade was.
Right, right.
right? So, I want to get this across to kids. I want kids to go into kindergarten knowing what I did not know in college about evolution.
right on. Yeah.
Right? So how do you
yeah.
do that? So
how do you do that?
How do you do that? So with the clades games, there are three clades of animals in each game, and one is the sauropsids.
Yeah.
So kids learn that reptiles and birds go together as sauropsids, and one is mammals, and one is arthropods.
Okay.
So they learn that, you know, spiders and insects
yeah.
are all arthropods.
Yeah.
Right. And then it's an animal matching game where you lay these cards out. It's a lot like the game Set.
Sure.
So Set is you're trying to figure out what a pattern of how three cards go together. and everyone is looking at them at the same time, but they're abstract shapes and colors and whatever. So this is, instead of being abstract, it's, well, so here are three arthropods of the land.
Yeah.
Right? And so you can, if you put those together with two sauropsids of the air, then your third one will have to be one mammal of the water. Right? Which would be like a whale or a pinniped.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
And so it plays fast because you're not waiting for turns. Everyone's looking at the same cards at the same time.
Okay, good. Yeah.
And you're gathering animals. And you know what? Kids love animals. So this
and
is
bugs
all,
and
right?
All
right?
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And bugs are animals.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
And so this is all Karen's art. Right?
Oh, nice. Oh, that's great.
Yeah. Yeah. And again, she can really, you know, here's our, like, her mammoth is one of the coolest mammoths. You know, just, it's a, well, mostly a silhouette, but it's got a little detail, yeah. and she just does a great, great job.
And then it's even an app now.
And it's even an app now.
So it's a game that we can play on our phones?
Right. It's called Plagues Solo, right? Okay. So you can play it on iOS and Android.
Now, was it made for kids to play? Isn't it?
Yes,
obviously, a lot of us don't know enough about this, so we can learn it even as adults, as you say. But you wrote it so that a kid could play.
A kid's on up.
Yes.
Right? Like, I like it. It's, you know, it's a relaxing little puzzle game
exactly,
where you look among cards and try to figure out what the match
is. Starbucks.
Yeah, yeah,
exactly.
That's right.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's played solo. A lot of people have asked me or Karen, like, how can we buy your stuff so that you get the biggest cut?
Yes.
And Clay Solo
is the way to do that.
That is right.
Yeah. Okay.
Because we're not paying for a printer.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah, right on. Okay, well, listen. So, as I was researching and getting ready for today, and of course, I know your work from like I say, way back in the old days. And I remember when I saw your name on D&D, and I was like, holy cow, like the guy that made Over the Edge and Ars Magica is writing D&D. Like, okay. But as I was doing my research for today, and I found, this actually came across my Twitter feed a couple of days ago.
Yeah.
And someone had done a screen capture of a tweet that you had posted
where
you were talking about race science and putting scare quotes around race science intentionally. And this has led one or two people on Reddit and on Twitter to sort of accuse you of being a closet racist.
Yes.
Like that kind of, that people will say things like, I know you love these games, but isn't it a shame when the people that make these games turn out to be evil racists?
Yeah.
And I have the tweet.
Okay.
So let's talk about it real quick.
Yeah. There's a lot of misunderstandings and a lot of misinformation, so I'm happy to talk about it.
Yes, exactly. I say that, but now I don't know. Another reason that race science is on the rise again is that the race-free science that we were taught in the 20th century has turned out to be only half true.
Yeah.
Liberals don't want to touch the new evidence.
Yeah.
So racists have the new information all to themselves.
Yeah.
And you link to an article.
Yeah.
Help us to understand what you were trying to say with that.
Sure. So for 18 months, Amy Harman at the New York Times has been investigating why is this racist pseudoscience rising up again.
Yes.
Right?
Okay.
Right? So for years, there's been, for decades.
I can't imagine what's been happening over the last 18 months that might have led racism.
Yeah.
But go on.
So when I learned about race as studying race as a sociologist back in the 80s.
Yes. Okay.
Stephen Jay Gould and Lewontin, and they were all saying, right, there's no biological correlate to this at all. And so that's what I would say. I would say that race is sort of like your astrological sign, that there's nothing to it.
It's a social construct.
It's totally a social construct.
I'm a former English professor.
Okay.
I taught cultural studies for years. And so, but go on.
Right. So, and when I say that's half true, a lot of it is a social construct, but there's some biology behind it that I didn't know about 25 years ago.
Okay.
So about 25 years ago, my biracial daughter was born.
Yes.
Right? And one of the first things that the nurse said was, you can see that, like, physically she's advanced. And I was like, oh, I've got good genes. She's advanced. And she said, well, all black babies are born advanced, which is supposed to be impossible, according to what I had heard. There wasn't supposed to be any difference at all. And so over the years, I sort of kept my ears open, and it turned out that doctors have discovered some kind of innocuous differences, like how soon do black babies hit their gross motor milestones? Well, earlier than white kids, right? how much weight can a black person carry before they become a beast? Well, a little more than a white person and a good deal more than an Asian person. Mm. Oh, okay. I never knew that stuff was true.
Right.
And so there's still a lot of misunderstanding. There's still a lot of the people who say the social construct thing is 100% true and there's no biology behind it. And people like Angela Nagel have looked at the alt-right.
Yeah.
And one of the things that the alt-right banks on is they find errors that the people on the left are saying.
Yes.
And then they say, see, these people are biased, they're unscientific,
right.
This is a taboo. And then they get to say, look, here's a PubMed article that proves that these people are wrong.
And because, and your point is that because scientists or social figures on the left,
yeah.
they don't want to engage with this material,
that's right.
that we're essentially not defending our position.
That's
we're,
right.
we're yielding the field yeah. to the other side.
Right, right. So it makes the other side look, they're scientific in comparison. Because they've got medical science on their side. And then once they've gotten someone to distrust what the people on the left say and listen to them, well, then things go south. And so, you know, for years, that sort of taboo against talking about racial differences seemed to work.
Yeah.
Right?
Right.
Okay, well, any strategy that works, I'll get behind. Right?
Yeah.
Well, that strategy isn't working.
No.
People are wondering, why is this stuff resurging, right? And for me, it looks like, well, one of the reasons is the left hasn't kept up, right? You'll still see people who really object to this evidence. Like the people who criticize me, half of them say, Gould was right and the doctors are wrong. Okay. And the other half will say, Gould was wrong, but we shouldn't talk about this new stuff because it'll be bad. I was like, oh. But that's what we've been doing, and it hasn't worked.
Yeah, this reminds me of the Supreme Court decision, which says if you want to take race out of schools, just stop talking about race.
Yeah.
Well, that doesn't actually work.
Right.
Right? We can't just not talk about that. That doesn't make the problem go away.
Doesn't make the problem go away.
Yeah.
Yeah. Maybe I'm wrong. Like, maybe we should double down on that taboo, right? But my opinion is that we shouldn't.
That's a taboo that's already been broken, right?
Right.
Like once it gets broken, once people walk into the space you're not supposed to walk in.
Yeah. And the alt-right loves the taboos of the left, right?
That's right.
Because that lets them troll the left and it lets them poke holes in the left and it lets them seem, you know, edgy and informed.
It fuels the outrage industry.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Well, anyway, so I hope that this controversy impacted like your professional life?
Some, and I have known that if you're going to violate taboos, people are going to dump on you for violating taboos. It's also been fun to see people defending me online, right? Like the guy who said if tweets are racist, I'm a hippopotamus.
Yeah. Nice.
So and the thing is, I want people to talk about it. I want it not to be a taboo.
Yeah.
And so people are talking about it.
Yeah. Well, that's good. I remember as I went back to your own tweet thread and your own timeline, and I saw that you had posted, you know, things like by a graduate student with research showing that there wasn't really that genetic differences were more important based on regional differences than by race.
That's the big finding, right? Like what I would like us progressives to do is to sort of leapfrog the biology of race and get to the biology of local regional groups. Right, because the idea that
this seems like an indirect follow your evolution.
Well, exactly. It totally does. Right, like we are animals.
Yeah.
Wherever there are animals, there are genetic differences by region.
Yeah.
Right. The idea that there are a small number of discrete homogeneous races is clearly wrong.
Really wrong.
Right. But the scientific response to that is not that there's no difference among people around the world, but that, well, differences are way more finely grained than what you see here. So if you talk about the black race, well, you're talking about a whole bunch of people with a huge amount of diversity.
Regional differences.
The regional differences.
Right? I remember the conversation about evolution and humanity was always that, well, human beings don't evolve anymore because now we can alter our environment.
That's right.
So we don't need to learn how to live in hot weather because we invented air conditioning.
That's right. And that was Gould's exact point.
Yeah.
Is that he said 40,000 years ago, biological evolution ceased and cultural evolution took over. And so that's what I believe. Like Gould was boy, he was the guy back in the 80s talking about evolution and genetics.
But this is patently untrue.
But it turns out to be, in fact, it's the reverse, that by putting ourselves in new social situations and eating new diets and going to new environments, human evolution has accelerated. Right? And so that's why you find, oh, here, these people have adaptations to diving. Because, right?
Yeah, I'm thinking of Sherpas that lead people up the up high mountains.
That's right. So Tibetans have genes from Denisovans, an archaic human race, right? That helps them at high levels. That's not a racial trait because it's not about East Asians. It's about Tibetans, right? And so that's where the diversity lies. And that's exactly what evolution says, is that... genomes change really rapidly to respond to local conditions.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, so that's fantastic. So thank you so much.
Yeah,
you appreciate it. And I think that helped, because I'm learning, I should probably play clades. I should learn all those things, like you said, that you didn't know going into college.
That's right.
But now we can teach our kids.
That's right. Yeah, little kids today can know things that Aristotle couldn't have imagined.
Where can we get all this stuff? Over the Edge, we can get it at our local game store.
That's right.
Or we can order.
Yeah, okay. Atlas Games has their own online store now, so you can get it straight from them.
Oh, right, okay, good.
That's right.
And then Grandmother Fish, we can order.
Yeah, that's everywhere.
Anywhere.
Yeah,
okay.
The number one thing to do would be to go to your local, brick and mortar
bookstore
and ask for it.
Yes, okay, good. And then...
Clay, it's sort of the same thing. You can get it straight from... Atlas Games and lots of bookstores will carry other Atlas Games products like Gloom is popular,
Once Upon a Time
is popular. So they often already have an account with Atlas Games.
And the best thing that we can do if we want to kick you a couple of bucks is buy the Clade
Solo.
And also,
tell teachers. Teachers tend to really like Grandmother Fish.
And you've done a lot of classroom visits.
I've done classroom visits and bookstore visits, and I do evolution exercises.
Yeah.
So one of the things I tell kids, for example, is, these fish that lived 400 million years ago, they literally are our ancestors, right?
Yeah.
They are our grandparents, our great, 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 great. And if you had to say their whole name with all the greats... It would take you 3 years.
Wow.
Yeah. So that's how long ago they lived.
That's phenomenal.
Yeah.
Do you still go to cons? We see you at Gen Con.
I go to cons. I'll be at Gen Con. Yeah, I'll be at the Atlas booth a lot.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, I'll see you.
Yeah, showing people over the edge. And I want to put in a plug for Everway because that is also going to come back.
No kidding.
That's right.
That's fantastic because I thought it was out of print.
It has been out of print for a long, long time. But the people who sort of took over when... Wizards of the Coast killed their role-playing lines.
Yes.
They've been holding onto the property all this time.
And now are these people at Hasbro?
No. So they're local people.
Oh.
So Richard Temps Rowan is the current owner, and his brother Jesse McGatha is also working on it. And they are big lovers of the game, and they've been waiting for the right time to bring it back. And now we have Kickstarter.
Yes.
Which lets somebody come out of nowhere with a really cool thing. And
we've also gotten to a point, I'm thinking about Impaizo, where we're always, as editors, we're always looking at the art, and we're always trying to make the games more inclusive and emphasize diversity.
Yeah.
And so that we can create characters that every possible player can see themselves in the game.
Yeah.
And we've evolved a little bit as gamers, and so it is a good time for Everway to come back.
It's a great time for Everway to come back. We put a real amount of work into showing pictures of women and people from all over the world, all sorts of different racial features. I got a really touching email from a fan. He was a black guy, and he said that Everway had changed the way that he creates characters. Because up until he played Everway, his characters were white. And then he saw the stuff in Everway where it's like, here's a black guy and he's not a savage.
Yeah,
right? Here's a black guy and wow, he looks like a noble wearing silks in some palace.
And I saw this stuff, this happened in third edition D&D too. Like
there were
prominent character art.
Right.
That's
right. So that's one of the things that I made sure was in there, that like if we're going to have these iconic characters, like here's what a cleric looks like and here's what a monk looks like.
The monk, exactly.
Right?
Yeah.
So the monk's a black woman,
right?
So Asian features and all sorts of stuff you'll see in third edition. I was really happy to be able to bring that.
Well, so how far along is the new Everway? Are you involved?
I'm totally involved.
Okay.
Right, those people are local. They We're friends. I know them from way back. And so, I'm going to be doing a lot of the kind of same kind of thing I did with Over the Edge.
That's
I'm going to do with Everway. I think it requires less of an overhaul because Everway was always about the art and your own imagination.
Yes.
So there's sort of less of the background that needs to be redescribed. But,
well, and it was Everway was new and innovative and fresh, but its identity wasn't non-derivative to the extent that Over the Edge was. I mean, Over the Edge was a game about not doing what everybody else is doing.
Yes. Yeah. Whereas this was, we want to show you pictures that you will be familiar with and be able to use creatively in your game.
Yeah, it was a very simple system.
Very simple system.
Well, fantastic. Thank you so much, John, for inviting me into your wonderful home and talking to people.
No, this was a lot. This was really great.
And thank you to everybody for watching and for listening. And we'll see you next time.